Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Oh, yeah. Yes, I am. Not 100%, but I am you.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we go through the life stories of serial killers to see if we might catch a glimpse of why they displayed their famous, vile, and disturbing behaviors. Special thanks to my patrons who voted for this episode and who also get early access to the podcasts. Thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. Today's podcast was voted for by patrons and will be on the serial killer Russell Williams, but serial killer is kind of a gray area with this guy. So let's jump right in. David Russell Williams was born on March 7th, 1963 in Bromsgrove, England. And since we haven't done the history of the world for that time for a while and he wasn't actually born in the 40s, let's take a look at what was going on in the world at that time. We must remember that the environment and stress levels based on the news and, you know, whatever can affect the mother's stress levels, you know, the fetus and so on. It is part of the whole picture. So, as far as history goes, the islands just west off of the coast of Africa is where Hurricane Flora formed. The reports of the death toll vary between about 6,000 and 8,000, making it one of the deadliest hurricanes to hit the Atlantic in the 20th century. It also did millions of dollars worth of damage and destroyed thousands of homes and buildings throughout the Caribbean. An earthquake in Yugoslavia destroyed around 80% of a city. Another earthquake in Libya destroyed the village of Bars, killing around 500 people. Also this year, the famous island prison in the San Francisco Bay, Alcatraz, was closed due to the high cost of daily maintenance and repairs. It is now a National Historic Landmark. Also this year, Kenya gained its independence from Great Britain. In the U.S., the Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright rules that a fair trial, quote, cannot be realized if the poor man charged with the crime has to face his accusers without a lawyer to assist him, end quote. So public defendant, right? Or public defender. So this was a great win. Also this year, there were student riots in Venezuela. The Soviet Union launched the Vostok 6 spacecraft this year, carrying Valentina Tereshkova, the first official woman in space. In the U.S. in 1963, the Senate approved ratification of the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that banned all nuclear weapon testings that was not conducted underground, prohibiting atmospheric, outer space, and underwater tests. It was originally signed by the United States, the United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union. And this ban helped to slow down the nuclear arms race, and eventually 123 more countries ratified the treaty, making it nearly universal. Interestingly enough, as far as world religions go, for 1963, there were an estimated 890 million Christians, 200 million Buddhists, 365 million Hindus, and 13 million Jews. But the biggest news coming out of at least the United States was that this was the year that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And then Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. So this was quite the pivotal year, at least in moderately recent history, right? So, the town that Russell was born in is located nearly kind of halfway between Birmingham and Worcester, just kind of for the visual. His parents were Cedric Williams and Christine Noni Chivers. Now, let's learn a little bit about the parents. Cedric was born in 1937 in Bristol, England, the oldest of three brothers. He was a highly intelligent man who was considered quite handsome, who went on to college and graduated with a PhD from the University of Cardiff in Wales. His degree was in metallurgical engineering, which are scientists who specialize in metals such as steel, aluminum, iron, and copper. Now, in the time I had, I actually couldn't really find a lot out about his mother, Christine. But what I could find said that she was a rather attractive woman herself, tall, long dark hair, and she worked as a physiotherapist. So Russell was born, right? And then 2 years later, his little brother Harvey was born in 1965. And as Cedric completed his education and he began working, he and the family immigrated to Deep River, Ontario, Canada, when Russell was about 5 years old. His father was hired as a metallurgist at Chalk River Laboratories, Canada's kind of premier nuclear research laboratory. And Cedric made good money, enough for the family to live in a more upper middle class area where life was predictable, quiet, why I would even dare say routine. Now, one source in particular stated that once they got settled in, they realized that there were quite a few couples that swapped spouses. Yes, my friends. And Cedric and Christine apparently made fast friends with a couple that was interested in spouse swapping with them, a couple named Jerry and Marilyn Sovka. And so allegedly, in big finger air quotes, right, allegedly they began, you know, sort of doing that. And eventually they fell for each other's spouse, and Cedric and Christine divorced in 1970 when Russell was about 7 years old. Other sources say Christine divorced Cedric for adultery, so take that information as you will. Cedric then married Marilyn, and Christine married Jerry. So they quite literally swapped spouses, I mean, honestly. And Jerry, with his new wife and stepsons, Russell and Harvey, relocated the newly formed family to Toronto, settling into a nice house that looked down on Lake Ontario from the Scarborough Bluffs. And though Russell and Harvey would never live with their father ever again, sources stated that the boys did maintain a close relationship with their father. So once in Toronto, Russell attended a Montessori elementary school, which is a type of educational method that involves children's natural interests and activities are sort of fostered rather than just the formal teaching methods. A Montessori classroom places an emphasis on hands-on learning and developing real-world skills. It also emphasizes independence, and it views children as naturally eager for knowledge and capable of initiating learning in a sufficiently supportive and well-prepared learning environment. It discourages some conventional measures of achievement, such as grades and tests. Russell was described as a quiet, shy, and very well-behaved child. And really, during this transition, it was said that it was, for the most part, stress-free, and both boys adapted nicely. Russell also began taking piano lessons and trumpet lessons, developing a lifelong love of jazz in his youth. He also worked as a paperboy, delivering the Globe and Mail. So I'd say he was kept fairly busy during his youth, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. And the people that knew young Russell described him as respectful, bright, and grew into a reliable and self-disciplined teenager. So in early 1979, when Russell was 16 years old, his mother and stepfather moved them to South Korea, of all places, for his stepfather's job. Within a year, he and his brother were then sent back to Toronto to attend a super elite private school called the Upper Canada College. Now, this college is widely described as Canada's most prestigious preparatory school and has produced many impressive graduates. UCC is also highly selective. The school has a financial aid program which currently awards more than $5 million annually to Canadian citizens. Looking up current costs, an average annual cost is nearly $50,000, so that's just for 1 year in today's money. So definitely not cheap. And predictably, Russell excelled in his studies, playing sports as well as taking music and drama classes. I mean, he really comes off as a very well-rounded young man or adolescent. And really, that was all I could find about his childhood. It seems pretty cut and dry, but I think we need to peel some layers back, okay? So stick with me. I think we can all agree that he was born into some privilege. Middle, upper middle class is much nicer than most of us had, for sure. I found zero evidence of him having anything other than a good and normal relationship with his younger brother, Harvey. Moving from England to Canada would definitely be a big change, for sure. But in the same breath, he was just 5 years old. As far as I could find, he hadn't even started elementary school yet. His parents were highly intelligent with what most would consider honorable, higher-level jobs, and they would have instilled this sense of work ethic into him. But now he is a child of divorce, right? So according to justice.gc.ca, the government of Canada, quote, "The majority of studies indicate that divorce is an extremely difficult period for children with serious, immediate, and short-term effects. These studies can be divided into three types: those which focus on factors contributing to or which identify the specific negative outcomes for children after their parents divorce, those which identify emotional, relationship, and structural environmental factors that contribute to a positive outcome for children, and those which explore the connection between custody and access arrangements and outcomes for children," end quote. That's a lot of mumbo-jumbo garbage, I know. But studies relating to negative adjustments among children include the following. So these were actual studies that I looked up. So a researcher in 1978 examined factors that affected the psychological adjustment of children within 12 months after a marital separation. She examined 51 children in 30 families and found that the greater the amount of time lost with the father since the marital separation, the greater the maladjustment of the child in areas such as aggression and learning disability. The depressed or withdrawn score for children living with a single mother was especially high, especially for boys, and antisocial behavior was higher among those living with mothers than those in intact families. However, girls living with single mothers were no worse off than those living with intact, low-conflict families. A child living with a parent of the opposite sex was especially prone to problem behavior. And side note, I found that pretty fascinating, like the whole opposite sex parent thing, pretty interesting. And this is obviously not like if one of the parents is super abusive, neglective, like the child's in danger, obviously, then there needs to be separation, okay? But we're just talking averages here. So studies examined individual, familial, and environmental determinants of children's post-divorce adjustment and maladjustment. Environmental influences included physical changes in the neighborhood, you know, such as moving to a new neighborhood, right? Social skills required to meet new friends, and communication skills needed to express the increased anger that unwanted changes brought. The authors of the study concluded that a child's life-changing events, such as moving to a new house or changing schools, are the most significant determinants of a child's post-divorce maladjustment, followed by marital hostility and parent adjustment. Many studies found that children of divorced families experience lower levels of well-being regardless of scholastic achievement, conduct, psychological development, self-esteem, social competence, and relationships with other children. So while we didn't hear of any particularly negative feelings or displayed negative behaviors, it doesn't mean that this didn't affect Russell greatly. So go with me here. He was 7 years old. That's kind of right on that line where we become just a bit more aware of the world around us. So the way that I have always conceptualized child development is that their circle of awareness or their bubble of awareness grows bigger as they grow and mature. So from toddlerhood to beginning elementary school is a new level of awareness. You know, the bubble grows a bit. They begin to not think and behave like toddlers anymore. So 7 to 8 year olds, in my mind, is another outward expansion of that circle. We have heard several times that some of our more well-known serial killers were in the beginning kind of stages of living in their head and developing these fantasy worlds at about 8 years old. So it's food for thought. Then in that same breath, and in my mind, due to the sexual nature of what his parents were up to, was Russell aware on some small level that that was going on, possible spouse swapping, or at the very least, the father was committing adultery? We can't know if he knew on some level what was going on, since as far as I could find, he's never spoken on it. But again, he was again kind of at the beginning of that sweet spot where, if he had some awareness, it might have affected him negatively. But I'm not going to lean into that per se. It's just food for thought. It's just a possible puzzle piece. There was zero literature or sources that said Russell experienced a negative relationship with his stepfather. But in the same breath, Russell and Harvey were uprooted and relocated to Lake Ontario on the Scarborough Bluffs, again, right at that age. And then he was signed up for quite the special school, right? And I really want to stress the importance of this Montessori school. So if you have an idea, or to give you an idea of the other people that have taken part in that type of school model, was Jeff Bezos, the two founders of Google, George Clooney, Sean P. Diddy or Puff Daddy Combs, quite the scandal with him right now, Beyonce, T-Swift, Dakota Fanning, Stephen Curry, the athlete, Bill Gates, and Mark Zuckerberg. So absorb that. But you know, by all accounts, he adapted just fine. He stayed busy with extracurricular activities and so on. Brilliant. But then at 16, he was uprooted again and moved to South Korea. I don't think I have to describe the absolute culture shock that must have been. Equal parts exciting and wholly foreign. And yet within a year, he and his brother were uprooted yet again and sent back to Canada to be boarders at a private upper school, upper middle class, you know, elitish kind of school that was very prestigious. And I can't help but feel like the expectation of perfection was there. Now, was it sort of explicitly stated? Well, we don't know for certain, but I think there is definitely an undercurrent, if you will, of this idea of achieve, achieve, achieve. Why were the boys shipped back off to Canada in under a year? Why didn't their mother and stepfather come with them? Why couldn't they have stayed with their mother and stepfather? For me, it's giving kind of teenage boys need to get out of my hair vibes personally, with the kind of blanket of I want my boys to have the best of everything excuse sort of laid over it, right? But that could be just me. Leave me a comment. Tell me what you think about it. Do you think that there were some very intense high expectations of Russell to achieve? Let me know. But the source material overall didn't mention anything about maladjustive behavior. There were no instances of being withdrawn, isolated, no animal torture or murder, no evidence of deviant behavior or conduct, disordered behavior. I mean, nothing. Russell was fine, just, you know, fine. So in 1982, he began college at the University of Toronto, where he studied political science and economics. Russell also took flying lessons at a local small airport. Now, while in college, his mother and stepfather moved, again, this time to Hawaii for the stepfather's job. And it was said that his own father and stepmother were now living in the States, in New York, at this time. During his college years, his peers from this time period described him as rather lonely, and he swiftly developed quite the reputation for being a prankster, showing an uncanny ability to break into rooms and hiding silently to scare the resident when they returned. And also during this time, Russell began dating a student from Japan, and the courtship quickly became intense and very intimate. But then during his last year of college, the relationship ended, and his efforts to get them back together were unsuccessful. So his friends from that time said he withdrew from his normal activities, that he didn't date for a time after, that it was obvious that he was pretty upset, according to one college friend. But Russell went on. You know, he graduated college with a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science and economics with honors. In the same breath, he had pretty much isolated himself from his peers. He lived in a basement apartment. It was sort of a house with a basement and then two floors. He had the basement floor. Roommates had the ones above. He worked odd jobs, and he watched the movie Top Gun over and over, which further pushed him to want to be a pilot. At the age of 24, he decided to join the Canadian Forces. He turned down an offer to work for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and by 1990, he had earned his wings. He then taught at the military flight school for 2 years. He was then living in Manitoba. He was promoted to captain. He was a very well-respected military officer. I cannot stress this enough. By this time, and I'm not sure how or where, but he had met a woman who was 5 years older than he. Her name was Mary Elizabeth, or still is. She was a rather impressive young woman herself, right? She was the associate director of the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada. So the two shared a love of being outdoors, golfing, fishing, and Russell also loved photography. Life became settled, and Russell seemed happy again. Russell was then posted to Shearwater in Nova Scotia. 2 years later, he was transferred to Ottawa, where he piloted the aircraft of some very important people, including high-ranking government officials and foreign dignitaries, such as the Prime Minister and even Queen Elizabeth of England herself. He was, of course, promoted to Major in 1999, where he served as a multi-engine pilot career manager. He even filmed himself in the cockpit of an air show with his team, the Musketeers, they called themselves. His marriage was great, career soaring. This went on for years. He eventually bought a small cottage near the base that he worked at while he and his wife owned a home in Ottawa so that he would be closer to work during the week and would then commute on the weekends home. That all sounds perfectly reasonable. People do that, especially when they can afford to. It just seemed like a very well-rounded, dedicated, high work ethic, and unimaginably respected man, right? And to really even add to that, he flew Red Cross workers and supplies to the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina. I mean, this guy was something else, right? Really kind of a hero to people that knew him superficially. What snapped in his mind is unknown. But what is known is that beginning in 2007, the now 44-year-old Russell began breaking into homes near his cottage as well as his home after making sure no one was home, of course, and stealing bras and underwear. On one occasion, he filmed himself inside a 12-year-old girl's room for 3 hours, standing in front of the mirror, wearing her underwear, draping clothes over his erection, and laying on her bed, self-servicing, if you will. So for 2 years, he continued to break into homes when the owners were gone. He'd take pictures and videos of himself self-serving on the beds of women and young girls, sometimes while holding their teddy bears. He stole their underwear and used items from their room for sexual gratification. Some houses he hit more than once. Some houses he hit several times. Once in a while, he would leave something behind to hint that someone had been in their house. Sometimes he even left sort of Word documents open on people's computers, like, hey, I was here. That's not exactly what he left, but you get what I'm saying. Oh, and Russell kept records of his adventures, detailed records, on his computer. And it was later discovered he did this sort of creepy, crawly, stealth mode crap 62 times before things turned violent. In September 2009, Russell broke into the home of a new mother. He blindfolded and tied her up, then took off all of her clothes. Now, she talked about how she had just had a baby, so she was unattractive, and he told her, no, you're just so sweet, you're lovely. He really sort of cooed at her. So then he fondled her, he took pictures of her for 2 hours. He assured her he would not harm her infant. And he made good on his promise not to hurt the baby, so there is that. Now, he stole underwear and bras from house after house, around 186 items in all. He once broke into a home and walked around naked while a woman was taking a shower. He then left undetected. All of this was kept in entries that he made on the computer. So at this point, the Ottawa Police Department released a warning about the break-ins, telling the people of the community to be careful, you know, be watchful. At the same time, Russell was promoted to commander of the airbase at Trenton while also breaking into some of the same homes, again, more than once. Some women were sexually assaulted, but most weren't home during his invasion. Then in November of 2009, 2 months after he broke into the new mother's house, he broke into the home of Corporal Marie-France Comont, went into the basement and hid behind her furnace. When she came downstairs to look for her cats, he attacked her. He tied her to a beam, duct taped around her head and face, found a lamp and put it beside her so he would have better lighting, right? He photographed her extensively, then recorded himself violently assaulting her and torturing her for 2 hours. He then duct taped her remaining airway, thus killing her by asphyxiation. There are some sources that believe he murdered before this, but there's just not enough proof. There's no admission, nothing. So we will go with this being his first, at least, known murder. But he was still breaking into homes and sexually assaulting women who, before him being caught, could not identify him. 2 months after murdering Marie, he was interviewed in the local paper for his military excellence. Not even a month after, he committed his second murder. On January 28th, 2010, Russell broke into Jessica Lloyd's house. He tied her hands together and duct taped her mouth. He then took her to his cottage in Tweed, where he assaulted her for hours, photographing and videoing himself as he assaulted her and forced her to give him oral copulation, so to speak. So after 21 hours of brutal sexual assault and psychological torture, he bashed her in the head with a flashlight, cracking her skull. Another source said that it left a definite indent in her skull. He then strangled her with a rope. He placed her body in his garage, and then he left it there for 3 days while he was gone working. When he returned, he took her body and dumped her about 15 minutes away from the cottage. So he did this in January. Most likely she was frozen solid. Now, she was reported missing, and during the search, Russell was stopped, and the police noticed the tread on his tires matched the tracks leaving Jessica's home. He was immediately placed under police surveillance. On February 7th, 2010, Russell Williams's tire tread was positively matched. The authorities called and told him, you know, come on in, we need you to answer some questions. He was interviewed for 10 hours and ultimately confessed to the break-ins and the murders. He then led the police to where they could find Jessica's body. And side note, his interrogation, the whole thing is on YouTube, and I highly suggest you go watch it. It's pretty fascinating. It's something else. So Russell was charged for both murders, theft, sexual assault of two other women, breaking and entering, and forcible confinement. He was a high-ranking military officer who was stripped of his titles, and his biography was removed from the Department of National Defense's website immediately. Cold cases of murdered women in the area were reopened and investigated, you know, to see if there could be any connection to Russell Williams. During the search of Russell's properties, they found his camera, a duffel bag containing a black skull cap, a manual on how to pick locks, boxes and pillowcases stuffed with underwear and lingerie, and two computer hard drives containing journals of Russell's activities as a sexual predator over that 2-year period. On the hard drives, there were videos and almost 3,000 photographs of the assaults of many women, along with the murders of Marie and Jessica, and a compiled inventory of all of the items he had stolen. Russell Williams pleaded guilty to all of the charges, so of course there was no trial. But while in prison, he attempted to unalive himself by shoving inanimate objects down his throat, like bits of tinfoil and cardboard, I think I read, so he had to be monitored pretty closely. He apparently wrote this crude suicide note on the wall in mustard, so he was referred to as Colonel Mustard for a time after. Fun fact. His vehicle and all stolen objects were destroyed, and he is currently serving a life sentence with no chance of parole. Additionally, he wrote several apologetic letters to the families of his victims, and voluntarily, of course, and his wife, indicating his remorse. In court, he pleaded guilty to 88 charges, including first-degree murder, sexual assault, forcible confinement, and over 80 offenses related to break-and-enters. However, as a condition of his confession, he refused to acknowledge the evidence of CP, if you know what I mean, that was found on his personal hard drives collected via internet distribution. So he was looking up Kitty, you know what, on the internet, and they busted him. Russell had told police that his sexual preference was for, quote, women in their late teens to early 30s, yet females under the age of 18 were directly targeted in slightly more than a quarter of the homes he raided, some as young as 12 years old. In all, he entered 48 separate residences, revisiting some for a total of 82 fetish burglary-related offenses. Indeed, he returned to one residence a total of 9 times and stole 186 items of clothing from another. Throughout his trial, he was reported to have wept and maintained a meek demeanor with eyes averted during the display of some of the less graphic evidence. It was said that Russell has been diagnosed with OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder. And if you really think about it, I think that jives. Sources carefully say that he is not a psychopath. He was categorized, actually, as an organized lust killer. So let's talk about that. There are basically two types of individuals who commit lust murder: the organized non-social and the disorganized asocial personality. The organized non-social type feels rejection by and hatred for the society in which he lives. His hostility is manifested overtly, and the lust murder is its final expression. Certain factors can indicate the personality type involved in a lust murder: location of the body, evidence of torture or mutilation prior to death, smearing of the victim's blood, evidence of sexual assault, and the availability of physical evidence at the murder scene. Crime is premeditated, yet it is a crime of opportunity in which the victim is not usually known to the murderer. So again, I think that jives. And then, you know, we certainly have flavors of sadism, a sprinkling of sadism, if you will, which is the tendency to derive pleasure, especially sexual gratification, from inflicting pain, suffering, or the humiliation of others. And Russell most assuredly did that. And thus we have the sadosexual serial killer. So tell me, what do you think the catalyst was? Do you think he might have displayed some childhood behaviors that might not have been reported? Or do you think the sense of lost control over his first real girlfriend in college was the turning point? What do you think about this case? Leave me comments, guys, or come join the Facebook fan page created by a beloved listener. It's just Serial Killing, a podcast fan page. Come over there, let's talk about it. Or you can DM me on Instagram at @serial_killing and we can discuss, okay? But either way, I would love to know what you think was going on with him, because he definitely feels like, he very much seems like an anomaly in the, you know, sort of serial killing world, although he's only been found guilty of killing 2 women. You know, some sources say a serial killer has to kill 3 with cooling off periods. Some say 2. Kind of a gray area, but you get the point. I would love to know what you think. And as always, thank you so much for listening, guys, because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you keep choosing me, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, guys, and have a great day.
Anybody who killed more than 2 or 3 people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.